The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
This week, a collection of art owned by T.S. Eliot's widow Valerie sold for £7 million. Gemma Sudlow from auctioneers Christie's took us through the lots.
Nicholas Hilliard, Isaac Oliver, Barbara Hepworth, John Constable, Joseph Mallord William Turner, Lord Spencer Churchill, Dame Elizabeth Frink, Lucian Freud, Francis Bacon were all included in the collection. So in a sense, it was almost a survey of British art across the ages.
How much do you think the interest in this particular sale was because of the provenance?
It's always a very difficult thing to gauge for us. I mean, I've worked in private collections and country house sales for 8 years now, and it's always an unknown factor to us. But obviously, it goes without saying that the more prominent the name, the greater the overall result tends to be.
Now, this collection was amassed by Valerie after T.S. Eliot died, but using the money from Katz. So in a way, it didn't actually have anything directly to do with him. And yet you advertised this sale as the sale of the Eliot paintings in New York and in the UK. So you were playing the provenance game, weren't you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the fascinating thing about Valerie Eliot was that to look at her life and her work and her collection as completely or divisible in any way from him is almost disingenuous, because from the age of 14, she set out to work with T.S. Eliot, and she made that happen in 1949. And even after his death, she devoted her entire professional career to preserving his memory, collecting his correspondence from around the world, and publishing it. And I mean, there are wonderful literary threads in many of the top lots of the sale. So certainly he had an influence over her decisions long after he wasn't around.
Do you think things matter more to us because they belonged to people, to our heroes?
Yes, of course. For me, just being involved, I studied Eliot at school and again at university. He's always been a sort of literary hero for me. So to actually have the opportunity in my job to go and see the flat where he lived with Valerie, sit at his desk, you know, handle drawings that were done by his father of cats that, you know, went on to inspire him to write the poetry that he did that became world famous. I mean, those are really extraordinary associations.
So why do we want to walk around the houses of our literary heroes and live their lives as well as read their books? We sent Richard Lee off to investigate.
I've lived around this area for 40 years. I never visited the Dickens House Museum.
Well, we're here in London for just 2 days and had to come to Charles Dickens' home. And it's fantastic to feel, you know, the different things that are here.
This room's a little bit creepy, actually.
We're standing in the bedroom now.
Yes, where Mary Hogarth died.
As you go through, the floors are creaking and you see the pictures, the sketching and the furniture. It's like amazing.
It's just the colours, isn't it, I think, and the dim lights, I think, give it that sort of creepy atmosphere.
It's almost 50 years since Roland Barthes declared the death of the author. But here at the Dickens Museum in London, the author's empire he identified gives no indication of decline, holds out no prospect of a fall. As they walk through the polished turquoise door of 48 Doughty Street, the Georgian house where Charles Dickens lived between 1837 and 1839, visitors are looking for only one thing, an encounter with genius.
All these books belongs to him, and the desk, and all the objects who belongs to him.
I'm very interested to see all his friends and acquaintances, Luke Fielders and Wilkie Collins and all these other people he was associated with. That interests me a lot.
So this is the study. This is where Dickens would have written Oliver Twist, Nicholas Nickleby and Pickwick Papers.
For the Dickens Museum's curator, Fiona Jenkins, this elegant Bloomsbury house offers a unique insight into his life and work.
At this very desk?
Not at this desk. This is a slightly later desk. And this desk is significant because it was in Gadshill Place, which is the last house that he occupied before he died.
How do you go about assembling the exhibits in a museum like this?
Well, you start with Dickens's original objects, which you've got quite a lot of. And then we're looking at the sources that are available to us that tell us about how Dickens lived here. So we're looking at inventories. We've got inventories of his later houses. We've got a bit of documentation about this house itself. And also then we're looking at other period buildings to try and build up a picture of what a Georgian house would have looked like. And then it's a case of buying additional pieces of furniture that we need to supplement the collection to enable it to turn it into a home rather than just being a house.
What do you think readers of Dickens' work get by coming to a place like this, by actually standing in the study where he will have written Nicholas Nickleby?
Well, all being well, they get a sense of the great man scribbling away, being amused perhaps by something that's going on in the drawing room next door, or if he's sealed himself off completely, he's seeking inspiration around him. Dickens would quite often sort of act out little bits of what he was doing in order to try and get expressions right and the things like that as he was writing. He would have been quite animated to watch, and hopefully that kind of frenzy and the hours that he put in order to produce his work will feel... will resonate from this room.
You can feel him pacing up and down these very floorboards.
Absolutely. If that's the case, then we've done our job well.
I'm wondering how a reader's experience of a novel like Nicholas Nickleby is actually changed by standing in this room. I mean, what actually the feeling of reading the text, of going through those words while you've been on these floorboards, while you've seen what's out his window, what that brings to the experience of reading the novel?
Well, I hope it brings a sense of sort of understanding of how he perhaps came about to write those novels. And it also brings about a sense of the man himself as well, because, you know, we're all familiar with, you know, programmes from quite a while ago now called Through the Keyhole and things like that, where you're looking at how somebody lived and trying to work out who they are from their belongings. Well, hopefully the readers have got a greater sense of who that man was.
If novelists can paint a portrait or evoke a mood through their description of their character's physical environment, then perhaps we can use this logic in reverse. Maybe we can shed light on a writer's work by exploring their homes, by contemplating the objects which surround them. The biographer Paula Byrne examines a topaz necklace, a cashmere shawl, a writing desk and other bits and pieces, hoping to illuminate Jane Austen's life and work through the texture of things, through the life of objects.
I wanted to be able to weave between the work and the life, and I thought constructing a biography around objects seemed to me the most perfect way to do this. So, for example, one of my objects was a silhouette, which is a sort of old-fashioned photograph, and that it was very common in the 18th century. And the particular silhouette tells a story of a young boy being adopted, and it was Jane Austen's own brother being adopted. And that was I was able then to sort of to go from that object to talking about adoption, both in her life and how it affected her and her family, but also her obsession with adoption in the novels.
There's also some other intriguing objects in the book, for example, her laptop, which is not something you'd immediately associate with an author from that era.
I know, I call it her laptop. So this object I love, it's probably one of my favourite objects. It's a writer's desk, it's a portable writing desk that looks like a box, it folds up like a box, but when you open it up, it's a slope, and you can keep your pens in there and your manuscripts, and most importantly for me, you can take it with you. So I think Jane Austen really learnt to write on the hoof with her laptop. At one point, she even lost her laptop. She left it on a stagecoach. but I thought it was so resonant. But I think also objects, they tell us so much, because her father bought her the laptop for her birthday, her 19th birthday. And I think we can draw interesting inferences from that. For instance, that he supported her writing, which it's clear he did from some of the other objects I've chosen. So for me, the object doesn't say one thing. It says many, many things. And it gives us a sort of portal into her world.
Yeah, you draw some interesting lessons from her royalty check as well.
Well, yes, this is, I mean, some of the objects are valuable pieces of jewellery or a beautiful, expensive cashmere shawl, and others are a piece of paper. But that piece of paper, again, has enormous significance, because this signified the moment that she went from being a very minor publisher who had only published military exploits before, never had a novelist, never had a female author on his books. And she left Edgerton's military library and found herself a new publisher who was Lord Byron's publisher and the most famous publisher of the day. And it was hugely significant, that move. And that check, that object, has only come to light in the last couple of years because the John Murray archives only just gone out into the public domain. So it was tremendously exciting for Austen scholars to say, oh, we found a check from John Murray to Jane Austen with her signature on the back. So again, tiny little thing, just a piece of paper, but really tells us a lot about her professional writer's life.
Do you feel you get something of a writer's essence from touching a piece of wood that they've been working on, or from a shawl that was in their family?
You do, you really do. I mean, one of the objects I didn't choose actually were her spectacles that are in Chawton Cottage. And again, you can't help but really, I suppose, imbue these objects with greater significance because you love the writer so much. And you think, gosh, those spectacles went on her nose. And you don't want to be too reverent about these things. I mean, they're just, you know, spectacles. But I think because we know so little about Jane Austen's life, that these objects somehow take on huge significance. And she wasn't rich. She was sort of genteel poverty, really. And you see that in some of these objects. Those objects would have been very precious to her, like her laptop, for instance, would have been the most precious item. And yes, you think she sat and wrote Pride and Prejudice on this. And you can't help but feel rather sort of touched by that.
The Austen Museum in Chawton spent £150,000 to keep a ring once owned by her in the UK. It seems kind of extraordinary outlay. I'm just wondering what it is about these objects that makes readers so interested in them.
I think there are probably few writers that would have that sort of effect other than Shakespeare and Jane Austen. I think because they're such huge writers, they're beloved in the academic world, they're beloved by the general public, and we know so little. Like, for instance, we think we might have Shakespeare's signet ring. We're not absolutely sure. People come from a very long way to see Shakespeare's signet ring, which has WS on it, but may not. It was found in his garden, but it might not have been. And there's something about wanting to come close to our heroes, wanting to touch them, and just bring ourselves closer to them. And I think, I don't think there are many authors. I don't think Fanny Burney or Maria Edge, any of her contemporaries, would have quite that effect. But there's something about Jane Austen. I think in the particular case of that ring, it's a fantastic story because, of course, the ring was going out of the country. And I think people felt very strongly that we don't have very much about Jane Austen. We should keep it in England. I think it was quite proprietorial, but I think there's something very sort of charming about that idea that it should stay in the cottage she lived in. I'm very glad that it's here.
The nation may have managed to hang on to Austen's gold and turquoise ring, but for the novelist Tom McCarthy, this victory has nothing to do with literature.
Fetishism. It's fetishism. Last year I was doing a reading up at Buffalo in the States, and they have most of the Joyce archive there, and they very kindly, you know, broke it open for me. And they divide it into two bits. There's the textual stuff, which is really, we'll come to that in a minute. But before that, they show you what they call the relics.
Okay. Literally that, the relics?
They call it the relics, yeah. And it's his cane. There's about two or three canes, which I held. You know, there's the lenses of his glasses, which you can look through. Their joke is, you know, you hold them up to your eye and suddenly go, oh, yeah, Finnegan's Wake. You know, then there's various bits. And these are fetishes, aren't they? I mean, it's like Splinters of the Cross. I mean, it's exactly the same kind of cultural logic as that kind of religious fetishism.
What do you make of the idea that readers in a couple of hundred years are going to be, you know, pouring over your coffee cup or looking at your laptop with wonder?
Fetishism. I mean, it's not that interesting, ultimately. I mean, there is a kind of, you know, as Walter Benjamin would say, they have an aura, these objects, because Joyce looked through them or held it or whatever. But, I mean, that's a hit you get for a second, and then it's not interesting.
Is it because reading a novel is a peculiarly intimate experience, and it's spending a long time with the thought of somebody else in this kind of extremely personal way? Is it just that readers want a little bit of closeness?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't really thought about it before, but if I had to answer, I would say it's probably a misplaced, rather false idea of what it is to write. You know, the idea that you're kind of communing with this moment of interior intimacy as though that had anything to do with the writing in the first place. I think it's misplaced.
I was wondering if this obsession with real things was one of the targets you had in mind when you were writing your novel, Remainder.
The hero of that, yeah, he's obsessed with real things and objects and the material world, and these things keep resisting his efforts to kind of contain them within some system of authentic mastery. I mean, they just keep literally tripping him up. No, they're objects. I love objects. I mean, they're great, but objects won't be assimilated to an individual. This is what is great about. This is what all of the prose poems of Francis Ponge are about, or even Wallace Stevens. You know, the plum survives its poem. The plum will carry on plumbing after you've written your poem about it. It doesn't read your poem. It doesn't care. Having said that, I went to Balzac's house in Paris, and it's really interesting. You see his desk where he wrote. Behind it, there's a trap door, because he was so in debt. He had so many creditors that would come knocking at the front door. He would slide out. He had an escape route. And, you know, his novels are all about debt and credit and, you know, capitalism. He also was drinking so much coffee all the time that he was basically kind of speeding, and he couldn't really remember. You know, he could knock out the words, but he couldn't remember where his plot was at. So he has a bunch of puppets on his desk with name tags on them. You know, so the contest or whatever is over here. This side of the desk is Paris, and the right side of the desk is the provinces or the, you know, the empire. So he can literally remember where his characters are in the plot. I mean, that's kind of interesting, because I don't think it does actually throw light, perhaps, on the construction of some of the novels.
You can imagine him getting the puppets to fight each other.
Yeah. Apparently Beckett's flat in Paris is like a crime scene. It's like a forensic scene. I like the idea of a kind of forensic, yeah, criminal, like some murder has taken place.
It's all bagged and tagged and ready,
yeah,
to go.
Yeah. There's a whole school now of criticism called genetic criticism. And what genetic critics do is look at the genesis of a text. And you can do that if you have the archive, right? So with Joyce, for example, the Joyce archive is pretty well preserved. And critics will go back and look at the draft phases of Ulysses or Finnegan's Wake, you know, the last draft and the last but one and the last but two and the last but three, and they will know at what stage this was revised and also what Joyce was reading when, in which case they do need access to a library. And they're even looking at, you know, what he underlined in, for example, the Origin of Species, you know, and correlating that with a letter he wrote saying, I just read some weird shit about, you know, orangutans. And then seeing when phrases like, you know, species oranges or orangutans of spacings, you know, enter the manuscript of the way. This is kind of interesting. And what you can get out of it is almost like a real-time replay. That is interesting from a kind of readerly point of view. I mean, it's also interesting to think, what can't it ever tell you? I mean, what are its limits? But I think it has a lot of things that it can tell you as well.
The division you made between the kind of archive, the kind of manuscripts, the texts, and the kind of ephemera is still valid there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's important. So with the Buffalo Joyce archive, yeah, they show you the relics first as a kind of fun, you know, oh, I've held Joyce's cane, oh, I've looked through his glasses, and then they put that away and you get down to business, which is actually looking at the Wake notebooks and the clusters of words he made, kind of working through them into other languages and their own etymologies, and that is hugely revealing. You can see how the Wake was written. You can't see how the Wake was written by holding his cane.
I'm just wondering if this kind of obsession with stuff gets in the way of actually reading the text, in the way of actually literature.
Yeah, I think it does. You know, the Jane Austen thing, I mean, that's heritage industry, isn't it? I think it's of absolutely no cultural interest to look at the cup of tea that Jane Austen drank.
Is there a connection between the cultural significance of Austen's possessions and their price tag? You can pick up a paperback of Pride and Prejudice for just £1.99, but Byrne is adamant the £150,000 shelled out on Austen's ring is money well spent.
This is a ring that she wore, and we didn't know about this ring. It was such a shock to the Austen. We think we found most things. It was a genuine shock in the community, the academic community. I mean, honestly, people were blogging, people were phoning me, emailing me, oh, have you seen this ring? And it's a rather beautiful ring. It's very possibly a birthday ring, because it's a turquoise ring and her birthday was in December. So again, objects have resonance, you know, and it is a lot of money, but I'd rather keep it for the nation. I mean, Kelly Clarkson may be a lovely person, but if she lost that ring and she went out on the tiles and got a bit drunk and lost it, we'd probably feel quite cross about that. So, lot of money, but for me, absolutely worth every penny.
Doesn't this stuff, these things, doesn't it risk getting in the way of the text?
Not for me, because again, what has been fascinating and the sort of reception I've received and talking about the objects is people have got very excited and very intimately involved in it when you talk about it. Somehow brings the writer to life. So for instance, when you talk about the John Murray check, it's amazing how many people didn't realise how significant that move was and how much she wanted to be a professional writer. And somehow when they see the physical manifestation of that, they sort of say, wow, oh, and she's making money here. Somehow it resonates. And if you just said, yes, and she made money and she was doing quite well, they'd say, yeah. And then you see the check and you say, ah, oh, there's something about the sort of physical, the physicality about it that brings us very close. I'm a biographer. I want to create the inner life, the world of her, try to get to the person. Of course, I smuggle in as much literature as I can because that is my background.
You say there are only a few, a handful of authors who provoke this kind of interest in their daily lives and in their objects, the knickknacks with which they surround themselves. Is that not a telling fact? Do you think this is not more a question of celebrity rather than literature?
No, I don't think that, because I think with Jane Austen and Shakespeare, they are so popular because they're so good. I mean, it really does come down to that. They have longevity for a reason. And in fact, my son, who's 15, says he finds Shakespeare and Jane Austen very difficult, but he appreciates that how important it is to read them and to be taught these things. I think the Brontes possibly might be another one. I mean, people absolutely fawn over those tiny little booklets. So I think they're probably in that category too, and there are a few people, but it's because they're good. You mean, you just got, you know, would we do this with Katie Price's, you know, I'm not sure we would. You know, these writers last, and as I say, they get a grip on the public imagination, because otherwise they'd have sunk into obscurity, like all those hundreds of women writers writing in the same time as Jane Austen, who we never hear. I know about them, but very few people do, and very few people read them. But Jane Austen endures because she's good. So I think the celebrity is well worth it.
Does all this stuff, all this biographical detritus and other rip-rap, does it get in the way of the text?
Impressively dressed.
According to Jenkins, we should never forget the power of the written word.
When you're reading the text, you know, you're lost in a world of Dickens and a world that he's created. So I don't think it gets in the way at all. And hopefully, visitors that come here are inspired to go back to that text and really have a closer read and perhaps revisit something they haven't read before, or perhaps discover something new and fresh and exciting to them.
So you think a place like this is getting Dickens a new audience in the 21st century?
Absolutely. We do have people here who have never read Dickens. They come through the doors to have a look at a nice house. And by the time they've left, they have read some Dickens, because at the top of the house, we have Dickens quotes on the walls, quite famous ones from quite a few of the famous novels, as well as perhaps a few that are not so well known. So hopefully people will be inspired to go away and read the text.
It's not just about, I mean, you say that some of his quotes, indeed some of his works, the man himself, very famous. But a museum like this, a creation of this kind of environment where he lived, a recreation of his home, is it not more about celebrity than about literature?
Dickens was a great celebrity within his time. He's a great celebrity now. But it's the work that has made him, you know, what we know today. And we have plenty of his material around us, which shows off what a great writer he was. So, no, it's all about the man. And it's all about what he wrote and how he wrote it.
And this picture that you're creating of him, this I mean, he was an extraordinary performer of his own work as well, wasn't he? I'm wondering if that's an excuse for readers to focus on this extraordinary life story of, you know, from poverty to this world celebrity, to focus on these things around us, you know, the desk or the carpets, the extraordinary red swag curtains, to focus on them rather than the difficult business of actually engaging with what he's written.
No, I don't think so. I think visitors really do come here and are inspired to go back and have a look at the text or visit the text even for the first time, because they want to find out why this man was so famous in his own time as well as now, what he's written, how perhaps some of the popular representations of his novels, like, you know, Christmas Carol, translate actually into the written word, as opposed to being performed by the Muppets, for example, which is nothing wrong with that, because it has a place. If that brings people back to have a look at the literature itself, then it's fantastic, as well as being quite entertaining.
Do you think that the way that you read Dickens would be changed in the future by what you've seen today?
Yes, it definitely. It would give me a more interesting view on his books, having actually seen his house.
When you see his desk and how he wrote and learn about how he some of the characters he's writing about, or perhaps all of the characters, are based on people who were working in the house or acquaintances of his.
I want to reread them. I do. It's like, okay, where do I start? And you just start rereading them.
Well, I'll remember it, but picking up the book and reading it, that's another story. I'll wait till it comes out in the theater.
Thanks to Richard Lee and producer Matt Hill, and thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.